There we go. Hey, we're back. Radio Mysterioso here with, how come I can't hear myself? There we go. With Nick Redfern. Nick, can you hear me?
Yep, got you perfect.
Oh, great. Right before we went to the break here, we were talking, I was saying that we would talk about what it was that was so horrible that was found in the desert. We kind of alluded to it before, but I was going to say, why don't you tell people what it was that your sources here wanted to sit on for so long and why it was so horrible and a lot more horrible than if aliens were here, at least according to the book.
Essentially, it came down to four or five experiments, maybe six or seven, but literally no more than that. And bearing in mind, you know, a few years ago during the Clinton administration, a whole huge, literally hundreds of thousands of pages of documents surfaced concerning the so-called human radiation experiments that were undertaken from the 40s through, in some cases, up to the 70s.
Right.
It's a very, very controversial experimentation. And the story that I got from the sources, obviously, you know, I know we're limited for time, so I'll just kind of condense it down. If we look back at the Second World War, the closing stages of the war, the Japanese military were attacking the U.S. mainland with something called Fugo balloons.
Right.
Now, the Fugo balloons actually weren't that unique, if you like, or sophisticated. They were basically a balloon with a bomb attached to them, and they were kind of calibrated so that when they were carried across from Japan, across the Pacific winds, across the Pacific Ocean, they were calibrated so that when they would finally reach land, or when they would finally descend, it would be over U.S. soil, and they would land on U.S. soil. And the plan was that the bombs would detonate and cause forest fires, particularly on the West Coast, you know, with some of the larger forests on the West Coast. Or, in a worst-case scenario, you know, people would find the balloons and tug on them and blow themselves to pieces, as actually did happen in one particular famous case,
right,
where a whole family was killed. And so these balloon operations were initiated from late 44 through the end of the Second World War, when Japan surrendered after the atomic bombs were dropped. Just before the war ended, West Coast newspapers particularly reported on the fact that the Japanese had made an announcement that the Fugo balloons were just a precursor for something far more dangerous and deadly. And these plans were for far bigger balloon systems, beneath which would be attached a fixed gondola, fully pressurized with oxygen, food, and all the provisions that were needed for what was estimated to be a four-day flight at very high altitude, from Japan to the United States. And the plan was that the balloons, if you like, would be used in tandem or in conjunction with bacteriological warfare materials developed by another unit called Unit 731. Unit 731 was a very, very diabolical and dark division of the Japanese military. They did all sorts of terrible things, like exposing people to plagues and viruses and freezing experiments, high altitude tests, pressure experiments, that sort of thing. And the plan was to have a crew on board these gondolas, and the plan was to release by aerosol bacteriological warfare agents over the U.S.
That they'd already tested on China,
That
they'd already tested on China, actually.
That's correct, yeah. There was a whole range of experiments that the Japanese undertook on prisoners of war and Chinese individuals as well. And the plan was to have a crew on board, purely because with the old Fugos, you know, there was everything was just a random act. You know, you just had to hope they landed in the right place and did some damage. With these, the plan was to try and release some sort of bacteriological warfare agents that would have a devastating effect. Well, obviously, again, to an extent, you're kind of predetermined by where the balloon's going to go, where it's going to be carried. Now, when Japan was taken at the end of the Second World War, and this is where the information from the interviewees comes from, in addition to finding data on the old Fugos and even these new bigger balloon systems with the gondolas attached to them, they also found blueprints, plans, mock-ups, possibly even one or two working devices, and scientific personnel and even the crew that were going to work on a very, very new and novel project. And this was, I guess, for all intents and purposes, kind of like a hybrid device. What it was a huge balloon array which would have rigidly fixed beneath it, a delta wing type aircraft, not unlike one of the Horton aircraft, and that the pilot could detach from the balloon system. And the plan was to fly the whole system across the Pacific and allow the crew to have even more control over where, you know, they launched some sort of devastating attack. So the plan was, instead of just having a normal payload below a balloon array, you would have this delta wing shaped vehicle attached to it. It would travel very, very high, be carried by the Pacific winds, and then when over the US, the crew, the pilot, would be able to detach the vehicle from the balloon system, and then hopefully, from their perspective at least, you know, glide it down kamikaze style to a location and again unleash bacteriological warfare agents. So it was really just an attempt to try and have some sort of control over where the operation, the area that the operation hit.
Now, so they never actually got this into operation. However, the idea in your book is after the war, the United States found out about this and brought some of these people over.
That's right. They brought
kind of
over
like
the,
a Japanese paperclip, Operation Chopstick.
In a very similar fashion to the paperclip operation, which saw numerous German Nazi scientists brought over at the end of the Second World War and then integrated into U.S. rocketry programs, aircraft programs, and so on. A similar thing, albeit at a lower scale or a smaller scale, was done with the Japanese. And as the interviewees mentioned to me, this particular project was just one of a number of novel and very, very strange projects that were attempted. And it failed badly. It was just too unwieldy. You know, the idea of trying to get this huge balloon array into the air with a structured aircraft below it and then have the pilot release it. You know, it was kind of like a rudimentary early attempt at vertical takeoff, if you like. But it just did not work. It failed. But the important thing is that it was test flown in the New Mexico desert. And the plan was for the pilot to literally just detach the aircraft when it got to a suitable height. And it actually, they weren't overly concerned initially about recovering the balloons immediately, because if anybody found the balloons, in a similar situation with the Air Force's argument about Mogul, that if somebody found the balloons, all they would know was that it was a big balloon array. They would have no idea that it was used in a classified project. But what happened was that the aircraft and the balloon array became detached at a great height, and catastrophically detached in the sense that part of the outer coating of the aircraft was ripped away when an attempt to detach it failed. And the aircraft was literally left hanging with its nose spinning to the ground, hanging beneath this huge balloon array. And then when they finally separated, the aircraft plummeted to the ground with the crew killed, and the balloons just, you know, sailed on. Now, of course, the primary motive, if you like, was to recover the aircraft, because that was the secret that had to be kept. Because, as I said, the balloons, if they were found, were just balloons. No one would know what they were being used for. And by the following morning, this was a late afternoon launch attempt, and by the following morning, the crash site of the aircraft and the Japanese crew had been made. It had been sealed, it had been contained, and recovery took a couple of days to clear all the materials up. And the witnesses and the interviewees said nobody outside the military had any knowledge about that at all. The unfortunate thing was that because the prime motive was recovering the aircraft, that's where all the attention was paid to, because it, you know, the experiment had failed and that was a priority, and it was, you know, forget the balloon.
Which crash was this?
I'm sorry?
Which crash was
this? This is specifically the Roswell I'm talking about, the Roswell one.
All right. Not the Corona
badly,
crash. Not this is the one that's associated with the Roswell incident that
yes,
the
so
people at
the
Roswell Army Airfield knew about, that Mac Brazel, but you'll get to that.
Yes,
go ahead.
That's correct. What happened was that initially this was hopefully just going to be a straightforward up-and-down thing where it would be launched into the air, the pilot would detach the aircraft from beneath this balloon system as kind of like a fixed array, a fixed payload, if you like, and land it. When the whole thing went wrong, what happened was that the prime directive was recover the aircraft, this is the secret, you know, this is what we need to keep classified, etc., etc. So all the emphasis was on recovering the aircraft, and which occurred the following morning. and the balloon array was seen as a lesser priority. However, when they got to the crash site, what they found was, as I mentioned, that part of the outer coating of the vehicle had been ripped apart, been ripped open when the attempt to separate the two vehicles occurred. And in a worst case beyond that as well, one of the crew members apparently had actually been sucked out of the aircraft. So what happened was that if they had the site of the aircraft secured along with the bulk of the crew, but the balloon array was gone, which normally under normal circumstances wouldn't have mattered. They would have just recovered that at a later point. But they were then, as I said, in a worst case scenario, missing also part of the outer coating of the vehicle and one of the crew members. So then the emphasis became, we've got to find the debris. And as one of the interviewees told me, it was just purely bad luck in the, looking at the size of the New Mexico desert, it was just purely bad luck that they missed the crash site of the balloons. And unfortunately, again, in a worst case scenario, you have this huge desert, but what happens is actually stumbled upon by a civilian, Matt Brazel. Now, Brazel found, according to the interviewees, the huge balloon array that came down after the separation from the aircraft. It obviously traveled on for miles and then came down on the Foster Ranch where Brazel worked. And some distance from the balloon array, he also found the remains being the operative term, not just a body, but I mean like decomposing, smashed to a pulp remains of the final crew member. And so then Brazel went into town, spoke to the sheriff, was interviewed, and at this point only spoke about finding the debris. And when he was later debriefed by one of the intelligence guys, Sheridan Cavett, Cavett recognized that Brazel was, scared rigid. And Cavett and the people at Roswell apparently had not at that time been briefed on the fact that a classified operation at White Sands had gone wrong. And said, what's wrong? Why are you incredibly scared, for want of a better term? And Brazel basically said, well, there was something else he hadn't discussed, and then it came out that he'd found this body. And so then Cavett, who was later told by White Sands, well, yes, it's a classified balloon project we've launched, but don't talk about it. This was unfortunately after the press release was put out, I should stress, because Roswell at that time hadn't been told what this particular experiment was. But when they put the press release out, then White Sands said, you should not have put that press release out. This is a classified operation we were working on. And Roswell said, well, you should have told us. We checked. Nobody admitted to losing anything. And apparently the reason nobody admitted to it was because they were confident that initially that they got all the material evidence recovered. But then when it became apparent that, Roswell had gone on its own initiative and said, well, we think we found a flying disc, White Sands then realize that that Roswell has compromised a classified project. So they say to Cavett, well, okay, this is a classified balloon project that we were flying, that this guy Brazel found. And Cavett said, well, that's all well and good, but he's just told us he'd found a body. Now, at that point, they hadn't even told Cavett because, in a best case scenario, they were hoping that the body would never be found or be found by predators and, or would be destroyed by the elements. And so then, that's why the hastily constructed cover story that this was a weather balloon was then put into place, because by this time Roswell had been briefed on the fact that they'd just, released a press release announcing to the world that they thought they'd found a flying disc. When in actual fact, they blundered into this White Sands operation and compromised the secrecy surrounding that.
Okay.
So that broadly, although it's kind of a complex and strange story, that appears to be what happened, that you had this separation of the aircraft and the balloon system, with one coming down at one site, one coming down at the other, White Sands not wanting to inform Roswell about the true nature of the event, Roswell interpreting it as a disc and actually making an announcement, which was the worst thing that could have happened, and then having to make a hasty withdrawal afterwards.
Well, I have a few specific questions about that, which you've probably addressed on the internet, etc. And also, we had a listener that had a question, and I'll give his first. He had a couple actually.
Who is this?
This is Stuart Miller.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, exactly which body parts were found on the by Mac Brazel on his, well, actually it wasn't his ranch.
As far as I know, it was a complete body. But the problem was that Brazel found a body at least a day after he found the debris. It wasn't at the same time or in the same location. It was just on another part of the ranch, and this was a huge ranch.
Uh-huh.
Now, bearing in mind this was July, you know, the hot summer heat in, of all places, the desert.
Yeah.
So what you have this body sucked out of an aircraft and then that hit the ground, you know, from a fairly high level. So it was sort of, you know, destroyed to a pulp to a great extent anyway, albeit it was still recognizable as a human being. And it was also decomposing through the desert heat. So I guess you could call it body parts, but it was body parts not because it was just like an arm or a leg here or an arm or a leg there, but purely because A, it had smashed into the ground from an extreme height, and B, it was partly decomposed.
Uh-huh.
But it was, as according to the sources at least, you know, an intact body when it hit the ground.
Okay, there's a slight confusion here, at least with me, because in the book you describe the White Sands people as using not only, you know, fully intact, fully human, although small, perfectly normal Japanese pilots, but also these people that were supposedly had some sort of genetic problems or deformation or something like. Where did those people come from? Why were they using them? And were these some of the bodies that people said that they found? And
right. Yeah, this is where it gets a little bit confusing, and some people have assumed that, you know, I'm talking about same bodies used in each experiment. I'm not. The story I got was that the aircraft that crashed at Roswell was a glider and this huge balloon system in kind of like a hybrid type device, which was designed to separate, and that was actually piloted by a fully trained crew, the same crew that would have been used on the mission against the United States had the war not come to an end. Now, what you also have going on, according to the sources, is highly controversial high-altitude exposure experiments. And there's no doubt that high-altitude exposure experiments were undertaken in the mid to late 1940s, you know, launching balloons to great heights to determine the effects of cosmic rays and cell mutation and on human beings and long-term exposure. I mean, there are actually files at the National Archives that talk about concerns. I even have one of these reproduced in the back of the book,
right,
for people, if you have a copy of it handy. The document's actually reproduced on page 225, which talks about experiments in the summer of 47 on, quote, experiments on mutations in extreme altitudes. And that's an officially released document which deals with high-altitude flights in the summer of 47 in New Mexico to determine the effects of cell mutation from prolonged high-altitude flight and cosmic ray exposure.
So they're basically using people that couldn't fight back and probably didn't even know what was going on in these experiments. And there's records to show that this actually happened, that you found.
Yeah, that these experiments occurred is not in doubt. What I haven't been able to document and what I rely on from the witness's testimony is the fact that some of these experiments involved certain people brought back from the Unit 731 camp. So it wasn't just the case of utilizing some of the vehicles that were going to be used in tandem with Unit 731 experiments. It was actually some of the unfortunates that had been experimented on as well.
Uh-huh.
And now this reportedly included people with conditions like Werner's syndrome and progeria. Now, Werner's syndrome, of the approximately 1,000 people in the world today that suffer from Werner's syndrome, approximately 800 can be found in Tunisia and Japan. And one of the notable things about Werner's is that it's kind of defined as progeria of the adult. And what happens is that symptoms rarely begin before the age of 20, and people begin growing as perfectly normal, but around about the age of 20 they stop growing, and men are rarely more than 5 feet tall, with women actually several inches under that. And so, you know, these were quite literally little men utilized in some of these experiments. And progeria, no disrespect to people who suffer from this condition, but it's a very weird condition in which the person's height barely exceeds about 4 to 4.5 feet, and they have an enlarged head and no body hair, and occasionally polydactylism, which is an extra finger or toe, which, you know, so again, no disrespect meant, these people look unusual. And
yeah, that's also reportedly Turner syndrome is
three
also
or four
like
highly controversial, and probably no more than literally three or four highly controversial high altitude flights utilizing some of these people. And it was that, it was the unit 731 angle that was hidden, that or had to be hidden. That was the prime motive in keeping this under wraps. Wasn't the fact that, you know, they were doing deals with the Japanese, because, you know, the paperclip thing about doing deals with the Germans is wide open now.
Yeah.
You know, that's widely acknowledged. So it wasn't so much doing deals with the Japanese that was the prime motive for hiding this, but it was the fact that it would lead back to Unit 731 and some of their fairly diabolical work that was the need for the secrecy.
Right.
So there were possibly somewhere in the region about six experiments, all of which appeared to have failed badly from round about May to August 47, after which time the secrecy clamped down and the whole thing came to a halt and material evidence and files were destroyed to hide the paper trail. Now, you know, as I said, that although files certainly haven't surfaced on the experiments as such, what I have found, as I mentioned, first there was that mutation file, which is reproduced in the book, but I even found documents, intriguingly, again, from the summer of 47, which are of great interest to the people at Oak Ridge, which is where the old lady I interviewed worked. And these are files actually from the summer of 47, talking about how people at Oak Ridge, and particularly their biology department, were extremely interested in radiation research that had been undertaken in the summer of 47 on people with progeria and also dwarfs. And this was designed to understand diseases of the thyroid gland. Now, of course, this wasn't involved with high altitude exposure, but it's highly intriguing that official files have surfaced from the summer of 47 concerning human radiation experiments on people with enlarged bald heads and dwarf-like bodies. So, you know, somewhere along the lines, these files, although fragmentary, appear to tie in with this story.
I wanted to ask, actually, a little bit ago, I was talking about discrepancies between what's been reported in the Roswell incident as wreckage.
Yeah.
And I'll give you them one by one. Maybe you can answer them kind of short here so we can go on. The first one is that I heard brought up actually on the UFO updates list was the witnesses, Brazel, Jesse Marcel, et cetera, had described a furrow dug into the ground as if something had flown through the air, a very, very heavy thing, and dug into the ground and then kind of disintegrated. However, what you're saying here is that it was a bunch of balloons that had a piece of the aircraft kind of attached to it that had ripped off.
Mm.
And it seems like if some balloons came down, they'd just kind of settle down on the ground and sit there.
No, I agree with you. I mean, the thing that I'm stressing to everybody is that, you know, the fact that this incident was 60 years ago, you know, there's a hell of a lot of research that we need to do to try and determine, you know, the full story of what happened at Roswell.
Mm-hmm.
And by no means do I claim to have, you know, a full picture. What I have is interviews with four people in the States and one in Britain, all who worked in different offices, some in different time periods, but who had access to aspects of the story from their own unique perspectives.
Uh-huh. I mean, backed up to some extent by some things you found in the archives.
Yes. So, I mean, my argument is that if all the sources had if they were covering every angle of the story, they knew the entire ins and outs of the story, they had an answer for every question I asked, then I would be suspicious that they'd been coached.
Uh-huh.
But by their own admission, you know, the lady I referred to as the Black Widow from Oak Ridge, her exposure was due to the fact that she was working on one of these projects at Oak Ridge and had exposure to the bodies. Al Barker and Bill Salter, two guys involved in the 50s, their involvement was because they were involved in creating bogus crashed UFO documents to be fed to the Russians. And the colonel didn't even come into the story till the 60s, through 69. It was only in 69 that he was told the truth, at least the truth as they're telling it.
Uh-huh.
So the point I'm trying to make is that, you know, there may be, as the sources all admitted to me, aspects of the story that they simply don't recall or were never told because it wasn't part of their work. Now, you know, that's not kind of me avoiding the issue, but, you know, I've tried just to go in the book with those areas where the sources were confident they could answer questions and provide illumination.
But,
you know, when it comes to specific things like, well, was there a groove in the ground here? Or did this occur on a Thursday or a Friday? You know, those type of things are kind of lost to history, I guess.
Yeah. But some of these things are, like, real specific, like some of the debris found, it couldn't be bent. It went back into the same shape. Could not burn, and Jacques Vallée actually a while ago suggested that there was a material that did that in the late 40s called aluminized saran.
Mm.
But the thing is, you can break that, you can cut it, and you can burn it.
No, again, I mean, the debris angle is one of the most intriguing aspects of this entire story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the one thing I would say is that if you look at the testimony of Marcel and, you know, Matt Brazel, etc., there seemed to be something unusual about this debris. But if you look at the testimony, for example, of, I think it was Betty Brazel, you know, actually talking about, in her opinion, here we are, Betty Brazel Schreiber, the daughter, no less, of Rancher Brazel, and this is her exact words: "The debris looked like pieces of a large balloon which had burst. The pieces were small, the largest I remember measuring about the same as the diameter of a basketball. Most of it was kind of double-sided material, foil-like on one side and rubber-like on the other." Now, some researchers have said, well, Betty has changed her story in some respects.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, for the outsider, from a purely detached, non-biased perspective, you have to look at it like this.
Right.
But on one hand, you have Marcel saying it had unusual properties, and you have Betty Brazel saying it was just a large balloon. And both were intimately involved in the story. So, you know, that's not to denigrate Marcel's testimony.
Right.
But, you know, you have two people from the same time frame, from the same, like, location, both giving completely different interpretations on what was found.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, I think that is why we need to keep digging into this angle. One of the other things that was suggested was that one of the products that was introduced actually in June and July 47 in the newer balloons was aluminum-coated polyethylene balloons, which weren't widely seen prior to June, July 47, if hardly at all. So, you know, if a new product was introduced, which it was in that period, then, you know, is it possible that some of these accounts of you know, unusual materials were based upon the fact that people had found balloons previously and then they'd found these newer balloons with this new material, and that kind of stuck in their minds. But, you know, I will be the first to admit that, you know, there are a number of intriguing tales and stories and accounts about this unusual debris that we do need to address, and that is a problematic area.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be the first to admit.
Yeah, what the thing is with the people on the updates list and etc. is that they seem to hone in on three or four, to them, very important aspects of the story, and then say the rest of the story doesn't hold water because of those three or four aspects.
Mm.
Yet there's all these records to show that these kind of activities were going on around there at that time, and cross corroboration between people and documents.
Mm.
So, you know, there are some very serious questions which I was trying to pose.
Yeah,
here.
I mean,
I won't push on the materials thing anymore.
Uh-huh.
But as in a lot of things, the answer seems to be a little bit more complicated, or a lot more complicated than people had guessed in the past. Whereas you could say it was aliens that crashed and the government covered it up.
Mm.
However, you've brought up this very, you know, intriguing part of the story where that was going on at the same time. Now, what's your opinion that this could be some kind of mixture of what we've been told and what you've uncovered, and how do you think that would work out? How would that fit together?
Well, that's actually something that a number of people have suggested to me, you know, that perhaps we were launching high-altitude balloons to try and determine the effects of exposure on the human body. And there are all sorts of other balloon-based projects going on in New Mexico. I mean, one of the ironic things is that the rancher, Matt Brazel, who found the Roswell debris, the July 47 debris. That was actually the third thing he'd found. He'd already found two previous balloons, weather balloons, launched by the military. So, you know, this was the third thing he'd found. And one of the theories that was put to me, which, you know, is a very interesting theory, is that because some of these balloon trains were very, very large, you know, maybe a genuine UFO actually collided with it. And that so you had balloon materials and UFO materials all coming down together.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people not recognizing or thinking that, you know, maybe this was these were bodies from a high-altitude exposure flight when actually they were from a genuine UFO, you know, which would be, you know, amazing if that was true. But one of the things I've stressed to people is that my motive for putting the book out is not to dismiss the Roswell stories, but it's purely to get out to the community what I was told to see if we can take this further.
Right.
And answer the question. And what I'm hoping is that this won't simply muddy the waters more, or in many ways not even lay it to rest, but it'll actually lead to more questions being asked. And, you know, that kind of leads on to the broader angle of, is it possible that I was fed disinformation?
That was one of my questions.
Oh, okay. Well, again, I've never disputed the possibility, and I never will until we get ultimate clarification, that I was purposefully disinformed. You know, I would never be arrogant enough to say that, you know, that's not possible, that just could not happen.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a number of reasons why I doubt the disinformation angle, and I'll tell you what they are. One of them is the fact that right now the US Air Force, and by definition the government as well, still supports the idea that, or the theory, that a Mogul balloon came down and that the bodies were crash test dummies. So, you know, if, with those theories in place, it would be even more suspicious and raise even more questions and raise even more eyebrows to introduce yet another cover story. But that, because that would then suggest, well, hang on, if they're now saying it was Japanese people, then it obviously wasn't a Mogul balloon. So how can we now believe this new story?
Right.
So I don't think that holds water. Now, the other thing is that, you know, as far as the story itself is concerned, to me, it wouldn't seem logical to hide a crashed UFO story by saying that you did diabolical experiments on human beings. Because whether or not people agree with the scenario that I was given, it guarantees, because it's so controversial, that people will look into it. So if you want to steer people away from what happened at Roswell, you know, I would think you would try and create a really, you know, the less controversial story, the better. You know,
my
you wouldn't
name.
Try and create a story
well,
that involves...
Walter's shaking his head.
I'd kind of disagree with that because
okay.
You might, if you're creating a story and it's fake, and, you know there's no way they're going to trace it to anybody to get in trouble because you've made it up, then sure, you're going to throw it out there. And due to the social temperature of, you know, our society as opposed to 30, 40 years ago, yeah, that right there is something that is going to get people's minds way off the UFO or the
I agree with
things.
You that it
so
would get the minds off the UFO angle,
story.
But I think what it would do, it would cause people to just dig into the story.
But they're going to find nothing, no matter how deep they dig. If you know, what I'm saying is, if I'm the Air Force guy, the government guy that's told to make something up, I know it's not true, I don't care. That's the point, to get them to dig into it. That's exactly the point, is to get them to get fired up and spend so much time and resource digging into that.
Mm.
And you know they're going to find nothing. No one's going to get in trouble because these people are going to find nothing but what you plant. To me,
I don't actually dispute that possibility, but my only... The reason why I find that puzzling was that, you know, there's already the Mogul balloon scenario in place.
Sure, yeah.
You know, that's one of the things that confused me about this, if it was disinformation. If
people...
cover story already in place, then I could understand it. But, you know, having a Mogul balloon and a crash test dummy scenario in place...
But look how many times it's changed already. I mean, it suits their purposes few years to change stuff, you know. So that, to me, that's like, okay, it's time to throw another one out there because people aren't buying the Mogul balloon thing.
Mm. But, I mean, there are a couple of other things as well. One being the fact that, you know, at the time, in 96 and in 2001, you know, I wasn't doing any Roswell research, and there were no big revelations on Roswell due to surface. I mean, the thing with the Paul Benowitz story that Greg obviously, you know, delved into massively is the fact that Benowitz was disinformed purely because he was hot on the trail of things at Kirtland Air Force Base that he thought was related to UFOs. In my perspective, you know, I wasn't doing anything Roswell-related at all. I wasn't hot on the trail of anything connected with Roswell. The only reason I initially spoke with the first source was because she'd read my book, The FBI Files, which referenced the place she worked at. So, you know, it wasn't like, you know, Nick Redfern's hot on the trail of Roswell, we've got to steer him elsewhere. So that was one angle. And the other one was that if you look at the interviews in the back of the book, the initial interview was conducted in July 2001. And then, as I said earlier, most of the sources wouldn't speak to me for 18 months, and I literally had to persuade them to talk. So it was kind of like, you know, if they're concerned that they need to get this disinformation out there quickly, why the need to, or the not the need, if you like, but why the desire to not speak to me for 18 months if this was a, you know, a pressing desire to get this story out into the public domain. One theory that I guess could work, and this has been suggested to me, is that the sources themselves genuinely believe the account that they related to me, but that possibly that this was a Russian disinformation operation designed to make the American government look bad.
Which, way back when, or just
well, you know, that's one of the critical issues, you know, because the sources are actually saying they heard this story decades ago.
Right.
So if it was done by the Russians, then it presumably it would have been done decades ago. But, you know, do I discount that possibility? No, I don't. The whole point of doing the book was just to hopefully relate to people what I've been told and see if we can take it further.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, the only thing I have against the idea that this was the Russians doing it was that, you know, why has it taken this long to come out? If it was, you know, something that they were sponsoring, why didn't it surface around the time of
well, it just might have not worked
when
out
Roswell
right.
interest was at its peak? I mean, arguably now, interest in Roswell is nowhere near what it was, say, in the mid-90s
right.
when the 50th anniversary first arrived.
Well, maybe it just didn't work out as well.
Mm.
I had a question about something that we talked about earlier, and now I can't find it. Oh, it was about you talked a little bit about Jesse Marcel.
Mm.
But Jesse Marcel Jr. is still alive, I believe.
Yes.
Has he? He was the one. He's the only living person left that's claimed to have actually seen the debris.
Mm.
Have you talked to him? Has he read the book?
You know, that I don't know at all. One of the things I would stress is that purely through nobody's fault at all. What happened was the book's actually only been published for 4 weeks this Tuesday, so it hasn't actually even been published for 4 weeks. And unfortunately, the publishers changed the publishing schedule of the book. And so 4 days after it was published, me and my wife went on vacation for 2 weeks. And so I'm literally, you know, only 2 weeks into sending copies of the books out and, you know,
mm-hmm.
Replying to responses on, to postings on things like UFO updates. So,
yeah.
You know, it's very much literally only weeks into the publication of the book and, you know, only now just beginning to get feedback from the community and people at large. I mean, one of the other things that kind of confused me as to if this was disinformation is that, you know, a lot of people in the UFO community imagine that, you know, I mean, I don't want to take away from the fact that what we're doing, hopefully, is important research, but the important thing, I think, to point out is that the UFO community of today is very, very small. You know, it's literally a few thousand people. It's not hundreds of thousands of people or 10% of the population. It's literally, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 hardcore people that buy the magazines, that buy the books.
Right.
And so, you know, if this was disinformation, why go to the lengths of spreading this elaborate tale over 4 or 5 years and having coaching all these different witnesses and sources to relate their tales to me,
mm-hmm.
when it's only going to be exposed to about 4,000 people anyway? Do you see what I mean?
Right,
you know,
right,
it's like if, say, for example, Monica Lewinsky writes her memoirs, everybody's going to know about that. I think, you know, it's kind of egotistical. A lot of the UFO community are egotistical, and they think, you know, the whole world knows what's going on and in the UFO field. The whole world doesn't know, and more importantly, most of the world doesn't care. So, you know, my point is that why come up with these elaborate tales that maybe 4,000 or 5,000 people will be exposed to?
Yeah, but a bit more of them are exposed to that because these tales get out into the to TV shows and
to an extent they do.
Radio, you know, there's
the media doesn't take them seriously.
Yeah, you know, a million people listen to Art Bell or something like that. More than 3 million, I don't know what it is.
No,
so
I agree with you on that.
It's sitting in the back of a lot of people's minds.
Yeah, I agree with you on that point, but I still think that, you know, the UFO community is a limited community in terms of size. Not necessarily in terms of what it could achieve, you know, if we blew something wide open, things could go massive.
Right,
but in terms of its size and current exposure, you know, it's not a large community. So, you know, again, I'm just purely speculating.
Been.
It just makes me wonder why go to such lengths when, you know, it's not like, you know, the world's media are knocking on the door to find out what happened at Roswell. They'll do the token documentary once a year about it,
right.
But that's about it.
But this has been the problem of the UFO field always. I mean, there's more and less people, but there's never that many people that are hardcore into it. But the point of releasing this disinformation, as was done with Robert Emmenegger, Bill Moore, other people who either we don't know about or won't mention, was that these people will spread the information to other people. And like you said, with your bringing moles out, you get to see who's interested in what and why. And I don't know what the point of this is, at this point is with Roswell, since it's such an old story. Maybe Walter has a suggestion about that. But, yeah, I mean, I actually kind of agree with you, but that it's not that important. However, the exercise of telling these lies and where they go and who talks about them is kind of like a candle flame for a moth, or you know, a lump of sugar for some flies.
I would say that.
No, I agree.
To answer your question,
I mean,
about
the one final thing on the disinformation angle that I would say, and again, this isn't meant in a disrespectful way, but you know, you have these people all in their mid-80s. They all quite literally are in their mid-80s. One's actually in very bad health. I would almost say failing health. Who, you know, if this is disinformation, presumably they've all had to be coached and, you know, told to tell the tales from their own unique perspectives, and, you know, so there's no crossover necessarily.
Right.
And, you know, the idea that, you know, would four 85-year-old, 86, 87-year-old people, one in failing health, be able to pull this off over the course of several years of rigorous interviews and re-interviews?
Right.
You know, maybe I'm misjudging them, but, you know, it kind of makes me wonder if they would. Would it not be easier to have, you know, a bunch of men and women in the 30s and 40s, top-notch trained disinformation specialists, just coming to me and saying that they found these old files, instead of having old people, you know, in failing health on separate parts of the world, you know, West Coast, East Coast, Central U.S., you know, spread far and wide, all having to try and, you know, come up with the same story, if you like,
and
keep it going for years. It's,
Walter,
you know, when
you
considered all the various reasons why I suspected it wasn't disinformation, you collectively put them together. That's why, you know, I doubt that scenario. But as I said, my motive is just to put the story out so people can see it, and hopefully, you know, we can take it further wherever it leads.
Okay. What did you want to say, Walter?
I was just going to say that what you were saying earlier, and it's probably obvious to a lot of us, for the authorities, the official, the government, whoever, the Air Force, to continue offering, even entertaining offering explanations for this, I think it shows that something about this Roswell incident, as we call it, something about it still affects our world today. There's some truth that they definitely want to hide. That's why a 60-year-old story, you know, is still something that's even dealt with.
Yeah. I mean, I would actually completely agree with Walter on that point, that regardless of whether or not the information given to me was correct or not, or the UFO theory is correct or not, there is something about Roswell that is still circulating in the government's mind or the minds of the intelligence community, and that there was that something of significance occurred. Now, I suspect that, you know, that the material evidence in the book and the data in the book, if that is correct, which, you know, I still stand behind the sources. You know, I think highly controversial human experiments would be enough to for the government to still have kind of an interest or a concern about it to this day. Equally, I think, you know, the UFO angle would be a prime reason for the government to have concerns. So I think you know, I personally think we can totally rule out the weather balloon theory, and I certainly think we can rule out the mogul balloon theory and the crash test dummy theory. The crash test dummy one, I think, was the weakest of all.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I've even spoken to skeptics who said, you know, what on earth was the Air Force doing, claiming
right.
that crash test dummies that weren't even used until 53 and that were the same height as normal people were used in these experiments.
Right, right.
That to me, that was almost like someone on the inside made it so absurd so that people would look into it more.
Right. I have two questions personally. One
yeah.
came up, the one I thought of it earlier,
mm.
and then I forgot it, but now I remember.
Oh, I do that a lot.
yeah. The fact that you said that there were specifically people assigned to throw out bogus UFO information...
Mm.
What does that do to people that are picking up original UFO documents from the 50s and 60s, like Robert and Ryan Wood, who I have, you know, greatest respect for?
Mm.
But they'll say, yes, this does come from this time, and this is this kind of ink,
mm.
and this is, seems to be... But this throws a lot of that stuff into doubt now,
well, you know,
from my point of view.
Are you not, you're not just talking about crashed UFOs here, are you now?
I'm talking about all documents that come out... that purport to be from that time that have to do with UFO information.
Sure. Yeah, actually, that's a very good point because, you know, as I mentioned, particularly in the interview with the Colonel, you know, he wasn't just talking about bogus crashed UFO documents.
Right.
He was talking about having created radar reports, pilot encounters, contactee reports. So, you know, that does have a knock-on effect where you're quite right that some of the material that has now surfaced publicly and officially... which we think is genuine, how do we actually know that some of these documents aren't part of these disinformation operations? Now, I think, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't that one theory that was put forward with all those Kirtland documents, that although they've been released officially, they may not have been entirely genuine?
You mean the ones about the...
About the landings.
The
so
landings
on.
And the sightings and the,
yeah.
The lights coming over and the security guards.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that was the problem with the Aquarius document, mm. because that was specifically released to be given to
mm-hmm.
Paul Benowitz. And that was something that, as far as I can tell, that Bill told me he saw come in on a
mm.
on a teletype, on a screen.
Mm-hmm.
And then it wasn't printed out, but then later he saw it printed out with these changes mm. in it. So, yeah, the disinformation thing is composed of that kind of stuff.
The most important thing to note is if disinformation has been done once and we can verify it, and we can verify it, then how many other times has it been done?
Yeah.
What it means is that potentially every UFO incident involving the military, potentially, and I want to stress potentially, could have doubt cast upon it.
Yeah. And I've been going around saying, no, I don't believe the government made up the UFO problem. Now it sounds like maybe they made up more of it than we suspected.
Well, you know, actually, I'm kind of like you in the sense that I believe there's a genuine UFO mystery.
Exactly.
But I think the fact that there is a UFO mystery, a real one, a verifiable one of unknown origins, actually works to the government's advantage because, you know, if there really are weird things flying around there, then that actually boosts the government's ability to use that mystery as a cover for its own activity.
Yeah, it's their Rorschach blot to mold as they see fit and send on
mm-hmm.
to us.
Or to hide a bigger mystery.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, exactly. I had one more question.
Okay.
You talked to these people. They were interested to talk to you because you'd written your books.
Well, the initial one was, yes.
Yeah. How did you ever ask them what they felt about the UFO subject and what that was and where they came from and why they would and if they even cared about it?
You know, I did, but again, this doesn't appear in the book. I mean, one of the things that's and this is why I'm trying to do a follow-up thing, even if I have to do like a self-published, you know, do-it-yourself type book. One
uh-huh.
of the things that particularly Al Barker mentioned, which again isn't in the book, was the fact that he was in no doubt based upon the material that he saw. That UFOs really were flying around, and there were some genuinely mystifying cases, and particularly cases where UFOs are being seen in the vicinity of atomic energy installations. That was one of the things that he specifically remembered, was that there were a number of credible reports from those locations where the military checked and they couldn't tie it into anything they were flying. But again, he made that point that I make, that, you know, they didn't know what they were, but something was there. But the fact that there were genuine reports and people were seeing things was actually aided them in, you know, creating these fake stories, because you know, people really were seeing weird things. So if they spread fake stories, that would be reinforced by the real reports, if you see what I mean.
Right.
Kind of convoluted. But, I mean, he was absolutely convinced, you know, that there are and still are strange things flying about. So.
Uh-huh. How about the other people, like that colonel you talked
well,
to?
Well, the colonel guy and the Black Widow from Oak Ridge, their only exposure really was to the bogus material. Now, what was particularly interesting about the colonel was that he was involved in this particular operation to spread fake documents to the Soviets. But what he told me was that there was almost like this kind of, how's the best way to describe it, like a plan or a history, an official alien history that had been written by the government, which was bogus, but which the disinformation planners used as like a background to create these documents. You know, they'd come up with the story as to where the aliens were from, what they wanted, what they were doing.
That's funny. That's what came up in the late 80s along with Doty, that group, the Red and Yellow Book, UFO Cover-Up Live. That was part of that story, that the aliens told us where they came from.
Oh, okay.
And they had a couple of books that were like
right.
crystals or something.
But according to the colonel, the official history of the aliens was created by the disinformation guys, and the people who were making these documents had to rigorously stick to the data that was contained in these documents. Do you see
right,
what I mean?
Right, so that when the stories got out, they know. Yeah, that when the stories got out, they knew it was always the same story, so they could know where it went.
Yes, yeah, and the thing was that because they were concerned about Russian spies, they would release one document that would contain a specific piece of information, another document that would contain another specific piece
right.
of information, which was clearly delineated from the other. So then, if anybody started speaking about it in Russia, and you know they were checking in with people in the U.S., they would quickly be able to identify through these ringers in the documents who was speaking to who,
uh-huh.
and no real defense secrets were compromised.
Right. Well, we're almost out of time here. I'll give you some time for self-plugs. Actually, what are you working on now? Are you working on another
book? Actually, you know, I'm working on a book which kind of, in some ways, follows on from this, or ties in with it. Nothing to do with crashed UFOs as such, but what it is, it's a book about how the official world monitors researchers in the UFO community. Now, a lot of people are going to say, well, you know, I've uncovered material that talks about how, you know, UFO researchers hot on the trail of aliens are being watched by the government, you know, because they're on the trail of aliens. What I've found almost collectively every time is that that isn't the case. There's been this concern on the part of the government or the intelligence communities in Britain and America that some of us involved in UFO research are actually
not
using
UFO
the
researchers.
UFO research as a cover for other things.
Walter, I had to actually check that out.
Well, I mean, I can tell you one of the things I've got in the book is actually connected with surveillance of UK, British UFO researchers, because there was this concern that when researchers are going to certain military bases in England where there was purported classified UFO investigation going on and photographing the base and so on and jumping the fences, which did happen, that they're actually doing it on behalf of terrorist groups or unfriendly nations and using
Walter's
the UFO subject as a cover. If they were stopped,
gestures.
They can say, oh, well, we're just looking into these UFO stories about the base.
Exactly. That's been the fear from early on. That was the problem with Area 51.
That was the reason
for
the project
that's
I did.
The next
as an
book
agent.
I'm working on right now is the way in which the UFO community is being watched for various reasons.
Damn it, why didn't I think of that? Are you going to be... Are you going to be at any conventions or public talks or book signings?
Yeah, I'm speaking at the Hollywood, the New Fuck convention.
Oh, right,
say
right.
that word very, very carefully.
Yes, yes. September 2nd, 3rd, and 4th.
September the 4th, is it?
I think it's 2nd,
and
3rd,
then
and 4th.
I'm speaking for the Michigan
Labor Day
UFO
week.
Group. The Michigan MUFON UFO group. And that'll be on Friday the 16th of September.
All right.
And I'm also speaking in England on the weekend of August the 19th to the 21st at John Downes' Weird Weekend Conference about the book.
Oh, yes. The one that's held in the pub?
Yeah, it's held in the pub. What better place to have a UFO conference?
Exactly.
So, plenty of liquid refreshments.
I also forgot to mention Nick is the editor of Phenomena Magazine, which is you can access online at, I think it's phenomenamag.com?
Phenomenamagazine.com.
Magazine.com. Yeah. incredible, great writing, and his breadth of subject matter covers far more than we've been talking about right now, if you can believe that. And the book is Body Snatchers in the Desert. It's available at all bookstores, at Amazon, and any place else you can possibly think of. Nick, thanks so much for being on with us for the entire time.
All right, appreciate it, Greg. Thanks a lot.
Oh, you know what? I had one more thing. I know your favorite band is the Ramones. Which Ramones song do you want to hear if I have it?
Yeah, you got some.
I've got a few. Actually, I have a copy of Leave Home.
Oh, cool.
A live album with a bunch of hits on it.
Oh, yeah.
It's from Germany. It's a bootleg.
Oh, okay.
And then the normal ones, like Sniff Some Glue Bead on the Brat.
Oh, I've got about 75 bootlegs of the Ramones.
Yeah,
one.
You probably have three of this
one.
Yeah.
What are you going to play? It as outgoing music or something?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Wait, do you have a specific
song?
Have
you got Leave Home lined up?
Yeah, I can do that.
Okay, how about Pinhead?
Which one?
Pinhead.
Oh, well, of course.
Of course.
Okay, let me see if I can get the vinyl working properly.
Gabba Gabba, we accept you.
Exactly. Actually, somebody started chanting that at me at a bar once. Very scary.
Should I do some air guitar movements in the background?
Yeah.
Why not?
Let's see if this actually works.
Okay.
Oh, it works!
There you go.
Thanks a lot, Nick. You can listen to the song,
Greg,
if you want.
See you later.
All right.
Against his head, pull that trigger, now he's dead. Mama, life has just begun, but now I'm gonna throw it all away. Mama, die back tomorrow. Carry on, cause nothing really matters. Doom, 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 doom. Too late, my time has come. Send shivers down my spine. Everybody's aching all the time. Today, everybody, I got to know. Gonna make it all right, I'll face the truth. Goodbye, everybody, I got to know. Need nobody cry. There ain't no light behind this fight tomorrow. Nothing really matters. I see a little cigarette on my Scaramouche, Scaramouche. Here records on tango. Scaramouche and lightning, everyone fight this. Hey, Galileo, 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 Piccolo, Piccolo. Oh, oh, I see a poor boy, nobody loves me. He's just a poor boy, my poor boy, little light and all I see. It's been like, no, we let him go.
Let him go.
It's been like, you wanna let him go. Let it go. Let it go. Let me go. Let me go. Oh, mamma mia, mamma mia, mamma mia, let me go. The Elzebub has a better cool side for me. For me. For me.
Anywhere the wind blows.